the trend of westernization of management, westernization of Indian administration is a very sort of huge trend. There are many good things also, and there are many issues also. Obviously, there are good things because, you know, they have a strategic mind, they strategize, they have a whole tradition of end-to-end thinking, a lot of technology, and, you know, these are things that our people can benefit and learn. But what I'm going to talk about is that there's a tendency in the West to develop indexes, standards and indexes, and impose them on others. You make them global. So for us to belong to one of these indexes, join one of these standards, there are many issues. One issue is, are we compromising our own way of thinking because we have borrowed somebody else's way of thinking? Cryptocurrency failure, they had very high ESG rating. Some of the companies, you know, like British Petroleum, burning a lot of fossil fuel, not got good ratings. So it also depends on how you're managing, who you hire as a consultant. But for us, nature is living. It's a person. Mother Nature, it's a being. And this Mother Nature has rights. It's not just property. It's not just if I pollute the water and it's bad for the fish, it's because the fish have rights. Whereas in the Western sense, the problem is that the fishing industry will lose profit. When you convert people, you're reducing diversity because you're saying that yours is no good, mine is good, only my way is the right way, and I want everybody to be like me. And that's why you're converting people, you're reducing diversity. Whereas if you say, I'll be happy with myself, you be happy with you, you are you, I am myself, we are okay. If being different, you are encouraging religious diversity.
What is your fiduciary responsibility? So if I invest as a shareholder $100 in your company, your fiduciary responsibility is to turn a profit, to maximize profit for me. Not to worry about environment or social justice or governance. That is not what I'm investing my $100 in your company for. So how come this changed? Isn't this against the fiduciary responsibility of a company?
Hari Om. Namaskar, everybody. I'd like to welcome all of you and our distinguished guests in the audience and present here to this interaction with Shri Rajeev Malhotra ji and Vijaya Vishwanathan ji. I request our guests to please begin the session by lighting of the holy lamp.
I now request the Director of Institute of Public Enterprises, Dr. S. Srinivasa Murthy, to address the gathering for a few minutes.
Shri Gurubhyo Namaha, most respected Shri Rajeev Malhotra ji, Professor Vijaya Vishwanathan ji, Professor Shri Aravind Rao garu, and most distinguished guests present here, faculty and students of IPE. It's a great evening. It's a red letter day in the history of IPE. Shri Rajeev Malhotra ji agreeing to visit the institute. Thank you so much, sir. We welcome you from the Institute of Public Enterprise. It was started in the year 1964, mainly to help the public sector enterprises in terms of the training, research, and consultancy requirements. Over a period of time, IP has trained many IAS, IPS, and IPS officers. And IP started exclusive program, MBA program for public sector executives, MBA PE with the affiliation of Osmania University. And IP came to management education from 1995, full-time. So we have 5 full-time programs on campus with the intake of 540. We have general PGDM, PGDM banking, insurance and finance services, PGDM marketing management, PGDM international business, and PGDM HRM. Sir, we have 60 full-time faculty, and they are also having publications and they guide the students in various activities, and the students are there from all parts of the country. So it is a great privilege, sir, to listen to you, and we have been reading about you, our works, and certainly our students are benefited, faculty are benefited to see you physically, and listen to you is a you get motivated with your works and also wisdom which you are going to share with us. So on behalf of the board and faculty, staff, students, I once again welcome you to the Institute of Public Enterprise, and I also thank you for agreeing to the request to host this event. I thank Pragna Bharati, more specifically, and Sri Hanuman Chowdhury Garu, Dr. Hanuman Chowdhury Garu, and the entire team of Pragna Bharati behind this initiative. I don't want to take much time, sir. We'd like to listen to you. So thank you so much once again. Namaste.
Thank you, sir. Pragna Bharati is honored to have the privilege of the presence of Mr. Raju Malhotra ji in our presence. And I am very happy to say a few words about such towering personality. Raju Malhotra ji is a respected and distinguished thinker on Indic thought, basically educating people against the miscommunication of Western ideologues and Western universities about the historical and cultural knowledge of India and traditions. Raju Malhotra ji is a graduate in physics from St. Stephen's and master's in computer science from Syracuse University. Then he has started many IT companies in the US. Then at the age of 44, decided to come out of the business world and work for developing Indian thought. He has written various books, Breaking India, talks about the different forces and fault lines that are trying to destabilize India. And the most recent book, Snakes in the Ganga, is Breaking India Part 2, which also, of course, snakes deal with the divisive forces, and Ganga is a metaphor for India. So how divisive forces are destroying India. In between, he has also written books on very important treatise on artificial intelligence and its importance in the future of national security and probably the world security. And also he has written about Indra's Net, which is about the relevance of Vivekananda's thoughts in the present world, and some other books, and importance of Sanskrit, another book. Raju Malhotra ji is a founder of Infinity Foundation based in Princeton, New Jersey. And he is also a proponent of different changes in the education system, and also runs an educational council for Indic studies. We are all eagerly waiting to listen to the wisdom of Raju Malhotra ji. Pragna Bharati once again thanks him for gracing us with his presence, knowledge, and wisdom. Thank you, sir. I request you to address the gathering.
Namaste. So the recent book, Snakes in the Ganga, there's so many different points being made that for each audience, we like to pick what's relevant to your career. Maybe focus on it more than the rest of the book. So in the since you are getting into management and you'll be running big companies, consulting companies, you'll become consultants to other companies, running your own companies, the trend of westernization of management, westernization of Indian administration is a very sort of huge trend. There are many good things also, and there are many issues also. Obviously, there are good things because, you know, they have a strategic mind, they strategize, they have a whole tradition of end-to-end thinking, a lot of technology, and, you know, these are things that our people can benefit and learn. But what I'm going to talk about is that there's a tendency in the West to develop indexes, standards and indexes, and impose them on others. You make them global. So for us to belong to one of these indexes, join one of these standards, there are many issues. One issue is, are we compromising our own way of thinking because we have borrowed somebody else's way of thinking? And did we have our own way of thinking that we should have revived instead? Another question is, when we adopt their way of thinking, are they always going to be better than us because it's their way of thinking, and we'll be second class in, because it's their way of thinking? They'll control, evaluate, judge, and we'll have to comply with their standard. And so they will make the rules and they will appoint the judge. And so we have to always be sort of at a handicap. It's like the debate is going to happen in your native language, then the other side will be at a disadvantage, and vice versa. Same way, if there's a framework that everybody's going to follow, but somebody has controlled it, and they continue to control in the future, then they will have an advantage. And I would go a step further and say, is that a form of colonization to say that we're all equal, we're all free, everybody has equal opportunity, but I, under my rules, I made the rules and then you all play the game. So what I'm going to talk about are, for instance, as an example, what I'm going to talk about is ESG, which all of you are learning. All of you have learned ESG. I saw that in the course curriculum. Before coming here, I wanted to find out what you're studying. Everybody in India is studying ESG because there's a market for it. Corporates expect you to know. But E stands for environment, the whole environmental movement. And there are indexes to see who's more green, less green, and all that. And S is about society, social justice, societal. So who's got more diversity, who's more inclusive, who's got social justice, human rights. Again, somebody has to decide what that means. And G is governance. What sort of governance you have? Is it fair, and are people represented, and things like that? Now, on the surface of it, it's wonderful. It seemed like a universally desirable thing that we should have a good environment, we should have good society with justice, and we should have good responsible governance. But then the question is, how do you measure it, and who decides that index? So if you take the environment, there's a whole pushback under this whole environment, even in the United States, because people are saying that this environment movement has a criteria for evaluating, which certain people have made. World Economic Forum, some think tanks, Harvard, these kind of people, they've come up with this index. And so now they have trained consultants who go around, like these big consulting companies, the Deloitte's and the Ernst & Young's and McKinsey's. And they hire a lot of people like you also. You might be working for some of these companies. And in India, they have Indians leading. So we think it's all Indian stuff, but it's not. And then the idea is that using these criteria, they're evaluating how is Reliance on a scale, and how is Tata's, and how is this one, and how is that one. And so everybody's clamoring for better ratings, because better ratings means you'll get better funding. It's like credit rating. Now this rating will also determine how many people are willing to invest in you. And if your rating goes down, then a lot of investors will pull out. So there is that going on. But when you look at the facts, some of these, like this very big cryptocurrency failure, they had very high ESG rating. Some of the companies, like British Petroleum, burning a lot of fossil fuel and all, got good ratings. So it also depends on how you're managing, who you hire as a consultant. And it's sort of like a bit of a jugaad and a bit of a scam also, in the sense that, and now people are beginning to talk about the scam, ESG as a scam. People in the United States are talking about it, that there are, it's not transparent who made the criteria and on why they made the criteria that way for in measuring. And how come the people around the world didn't get to participate in deciding what is their idea? So if you look at environment from the Indian traditional point of view, you're talking about Mother Nature. That's what you're talking about. So to evaluate your behavior and your conduct towards Mother Nature is a very important thing in our dharma. It's one of the things that you have a responsibility. You have a duty to protect the nature. But for us, nature is living. It's a person. Mother Nature, it's a being. And this Mother Nature has rights. It's not just property. It's not just if I pollute the water and it's bad for the fish, it's because the fish have rights. Whereas in the Western sense, the problem is that the fishing industry will lose profit. A different reason. If I don't want to over-harvest, in Ayurveda, you only harvest at a certain time when the plant is in its cycle. Plant has a cycle, and you only harvest at certain points in time when you don't harm the plant. And you only harvest a certain amount. The Western idea would be that you want to maximize the yield, and you therefore optimize when to harvest, how much to harvest for optimizing the yield. It's not because the plant has rights and the plant is a being. It's not that. You see? And the reason you don't want to you consume too much natural resources is because it's man's property and may run out. You know, I don't want to deplete my property. So the whole tradition starts in the Bible, where God tells man that this is your world is made for your pleasure, it is your property. So if the world is your property, then protecting it, there is one kind of ethics and one kind of values. But in our tradition, it is not our property. The world is not our property. We are part of the world and inseparable from the world, and the world is being, is a person, personhood. So the whole philosophy of environment is different. And therefore, protecting it is a different kind of a standard for us. You see, so the question is then, when we are talking about environment, we are including animals. It's not just climate. So what about non-veg? Should we say that those people should be kind of in trouble because they are harming the environment? To us, they are part of the environment. You see, so whose philosophy do you use? And why is it that one civilization's philosophy, because they've conquered the world and colonized the world and the English language has spread, why is it that their particular worldview should become the universal standard? That is what, in my book, Being Different, I call Western Universalism, meaning that their history and their experiences, which are very good, very profound, very valuable for them. But to universalize it and say that this should be applied to all people everywhere is kind of unfair, just because they have more power. I mean, Native Americans have a whole different attitude towards environment. Africans have different attitude towards the environment. So whose idea of environment are we going to consider? And is it only a measure of making sure that we don't have too much carbon footprint and things like that? But there are many other things about environment that ought to be considered for us. Then when you talk about social justice, you know, that the idea they're promoting is diversity. The DEI movement, you'd all be part of DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. But India is the most diverse country in the world. So before they come and teach us how to measure us, the point is the loss of diversity is their problem. Because they wanted to conquer in the name of one religion, one book, one church, everybody else, and wipe out everybody else as heathens and infidels and so on. So they lost the diversity that was there. We have every 100 kilometers you go, there's different practices, different foods, different ethnicity, different deities, different languages, dialects. So we don't need a HR policy to bring diversity, because we might mess with it. We better leave it alone because it is already diverse. So this business of a codified, rule-based diversity imposed from the headquarters is a very alien concept to us. Our diversity was not the result of some centralized HR department in some capital which made policies and imposed laws and measured everybody's diversity and went around with inspectors and punishing them and saying you are more diverse, you are less, you should be punished and you should be rewarded. It was not the result of that. How did we become diverse? That has to be studied. Before you succumb to some diversity index and some diversity system from somewhere else, you should first ask, well, we have been diverse. Let's first figure out how, why, what made us so diverse compared to other people. That has not been properly studied. So why are we going to tamper with a system which has produced diversity by bringing in ideas from another system which has not produced diversity? So this is a philosophical issue that I'm raising issues that are not practically useful in the narrow context of maximizing your career. So when you go for a job interview, don't say all this. Really, but you should think. There are certain things you have to think and say, aha, they're making me do this. I have no choice. I got to put bread on the table. I have to make money and, you know, but I have to think for myself too. Maybe I'm not going to speak like that now, but maybe one day I will. Maybe I'll be the boss, or maybe one day I'll get a chance to express my views and I will. So I'm putting that in your thought, planting that seed, whether you want to talk about it now or later, or that I don't know, it's your call. Some of you may want to become, authors, writers, faculty, teaching another point of view. Some of you may be scholars who want to develop our index, what would be, according to our tradition, a way of measuring these kind of things. Now, when you look at equity in the DEI, the E is equity, not equality. I don't know how many of you know the difference between equity and equality. How many of you know that? What is the difference between equity and equality? One person knows. Very good. Very good. No, I'm glad you know. So, equality means everybody has equal opportunity and equal rights, but not equal outcome. It's like you're having a race. Everybody starts the same. When it says go, everybody runs. Everybody's equal chance. And some will run faster than others. Outcome will not be the same. I may not be running fast, you know. Somebody else runs faster. Equity means we want equal outcome. It's like saying that regardless of the scores, certain percentage of people of some culture or identity or minority have to be admitted. So the outcome has to be determined. What percentage will come from here, there, what percentage of male, female, this religion, this caste, that caste. So evaluating the coming up with an allocation of results by identity is equity. That is what they're calling equity. And this term started in the United States because they wanted affirmative action for blacks and for minorities and things like that. So they came up with this idea that we have to champion equity. But that's not the same thing as equality, because equality is of opportunity. Now, the irony is that the liberalism in America always championed equality. Martin Luther King never asked for equity. He just said, I want a level playing field for my people, whites, blacks, everybody. And whoever is good will win. John F. Kennedy, liberal. Jimmy Carter, president, very, very liberal. They champion equality. Even till the time of Bill Clinton, they champion equality. And also Barack Obama championed equality. But now, under wokeism and critical race theory, it is equity being championed rather than equality. So when you just get sucked into diversity, equity, inclusion, it is perfectly fair for you to raise your hand in class and say, can you please explain what is equity versus equality? If you want to get a 2-minute version, You might be familiar with the Bill Maher show. You familiar with Bill Maher? He's a comedian. And there is a 2-3 minute clip. So he brings in Bernie Sanders and he says, on your web page, you have mentioned you support equality. But your party is now supporting equity. Would you like to tell the audience the difference between equity and equality? So he puts him on the spot. And Bernie Sanders is very uncomfortable. He tries to say, I don't know. He kind of pretends. He first pretends and he says, but you have it on your website. So what he's trying to show is that by your own criteria, you're on your followers and you're playing double. You're a hypocrite because you have believed in equality all your life, but now the fashion is equity, so you're going for that. That's what he wants to say. It's a very nice 2-minute funny thing. If I have it somewhere, that clip. So if you want to know what is the difference between equity and equality in 2 minutes, you can do that. There are lots of if you just search equity versus equality, you will get a few quick answers. In your career, where you will be required to follow DEI policies, and E is equity, you better know the difference. I mean, none of you except one raised hand. You have to know the difference, and you have to be informed, and you have to be able to explain. You have to be able to ask an intelligent question, an innocent question, saying, how is equity different than equality, and how is it? Who believes in the equality and who believes in the equity? And you take the statements of all the, whether it's Gandhi, whether it is in our country, whether it's in their country, whether it is, you know, whoever, Buddha or all that. Nobody talked about equity. They talk about equality of human beings. So, you know, you are being brainwashed gradually into a sort of a way of thinking, which I would classify as colonized thinking in a sense. And it is, I feel very sorry because you have no choice. You need a career. And the careers that the universities are training you for are the careers that the companies want. And the companies want, as part of the globalization, this is what the companies want. They have no choice. So there is a whole world order which is imposing itself on Indian corporates, Indian universities, Indian think tanks and government offices and all that. And this index-based thinking is driving the education of people. So it's education to get jobs, to become, you know, important and all that by taking these ideas and values and making them part of your ethos. And that is, it takes a lot of audacity for someone to stand here and say that is a colonial system. It is not part of who you are. And it is not an easy, I don't know the answer what I would advise you to do, because you also have to be very practical in your life. But you're better off being well informed. Whether you can take action and resist all this or whether you have to go along with it, it's better that you at least know about it. It's better that you not fool yourself, you see. So there are many indexes like this I could talk about. There's also now a new index on religious pluralism, how much religious diversity there is. Okay, that's also coming out of an American organization, a Christian organization. When you convert people, you're reducing diversity because you're saying that yours is no good, mine is good, only my way is right way, and I want everybody to be like me. And that's why you're converting people, you're reducing diversity. Whereas if you say, I'll be happy with myself, you be happy with you, you are you, I am myself, we are okay if being different, you are encouraging religious diversity. So actually, they are reducing diversity. We have had diversity, but they have come up with this index of religious diversity in the businesses, and they're going around measuring companies in different countries and giving awards saying you are the most diverse company, you are the most diverse CEO, religious diversity CEO. So this way of winning people over, buying them over with awards, and then getting them into a trap, because once you've bought into their system, then they're going to evaluate you every year, and then they're going to say don't do this, don't do that, because then your rating will go down. So as long as you're in the ratings trap and index trap, you have to kind of conform to somebody else's rules, somebody else who made the rules of the game, who trained all the consultants, and who controls, you know, how you'll be treated. Now, you know, there is something in China called social credit. How many of you know social credit system in China? They're evaluating every citizen, you know, using facial recognition, what your behavior is. Are you mixing with the wrong people, the right people? Are you praying too much in the wrong church or mosque or not or whatever? They're looking at your whether you went through a traffic light, whether you paid your taxes, whether you did well in scores. I mean, every little thing you are tracked, like with a surveillance system. And this artificial intelligence surveillance system gives you a score of how good a citizen you are. It's like, imagine if the Aadhaar card, with the Aadhaar card, they kept track of every little thing you do. You know, did you spend too much, did you wake up late? Or, I mean, if the system knows your movements every second of your whole life, then it can come up with algorithms to evaluate you. And this kind of, this is what China is perfecting for all its citizens. And this is called social credit system. It's kind of like an index of rating citizens. And this is Big Brother then deciding who will get awards, who will get admission, who will be given preference for hospital treatment if there is some treatment needed, who will get in upgrade here, there. So your society will treat you and give you recognition and based on how good is your score. And so it's sort of like a government-controlled karma system, almost. Except this is government Bhagwan. Government is the Bhagwan saying, okay, your karma rating is this much. This fellow is better. Now you have to... So it's a way to keep you obedient also. So this is a very interesting thing that's happened. And the West is criticizing China for having a social credit system because the West says that it violates personal freedom and so on. But the West is doing its own thing, which is also social credit system. In fact, the West's social credit system is not individuals, but corporates. The ESG is a corporate social credit system. It says your corporate will be evaluated on how good its behavior is. So it's a social credit system at an institutional level. Every institution in the world to be evaluated, you see. So there's one AI system to evaluate ESG, which says that we will track the images. Facial recognition can recognize the board members and the CEO, where he's been, who he's shaking hands with, is he hugging only white people or also black people. So, you know, Mukesh Ambani's ESG could depend on everywhere he goes, whether he does namaskar to the lower level person or only a higher level person, and did he shake hands with the Dalit or not. I mean, so this ESG rating by AI will come up with the score of Mukesh Ambani's ESG. So this kind of an AI-based social credit is a very strange kind of a thing. And these things are not going to bother me. I'm okay. I'm 72 years old. Nothing's going to affect me. But your life is going to be run by these things. And that's what I'm telling you about. So you have to be concerned about being evaluated, measured, watched, surveillance, and put into these indexes and into these various ways of being rewarded and so on. Now, and the worst part of it is, in at least in China's case, they are controlling. It's not a foreign country. Their own government controlling. In our case, it is Western indexes controlling you. Western indexes controlling you. Your behavior on social media controlled by the Googles of the world in terms of what they think of you or your profile and whether your post will boost or not boost and whether you have said something that they want you to say or not say, you know, and your company's social credit as ESG and other kind of rating systems controlled by Western consultants who are coming and evaluating you, and bankers and financial industry deciding whether to fund you or not. So this is a future risk of sovereignty of a country, it's something that you should. I would like that some professors here should also give you a lecture on what are the risks and pitfalls of all the things, all the systems that you are being taught. you should also reflect on, okay, how can it backfire on my values, and should I be careful about it? So I'm addressing the students, but I'm also hoping some faculty will take note of this. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll take some questions later on after Vijaya has spoken. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your enlightening address. I am now delighted to introduce Professor Srimati Vijaya Vishwanathan ji. Srimati Vijaya ji is the co-author of Snakes in the Ganga book. Vijaya Vishwanathan ji is an MBA from Wharton Business School of University of Pennsylvania. She is also an engineering graduate from University of Massachusetts. She is a great scholar in Indic studies and presently associated with, according to her online profile, Bhishma School of Indic Studies, Pune, and Sanskrit Academy, Chennai, Agastya Gurukulam in the US. So she is a very learned scholar, both in technology and also in terms of Vedic and Indian philosophy and Indian culture. So I request her to address this gathering and share her views with us. Thank you, ma'am.
Namaskar, Vibhya. So Rajiv ji talked about ESG, and I just wanted to add a few more points to tell you what some of the people who are waking up to this nightmare are doing in the West. So there is a big movement in the West where they are asking companies, especially publicly traded companies, what is your fiduciary responsibility? So if I invest as a shareholder $100 in your company, your fiduciary responsibility is to turn a profit, to maximize profit for me. Not to worry about environment or social justice or governance. That is not what I'm investing my $100 in your company for. So how come this changed? Isn't this against the fiduciary responsibility of a company? Because I never voted for this. So what has happened is the big pension funds in the US have been investing in three large institutional investors, which is Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock. And these guys, right, Larry Fink of BlackRock especially, they control trillions of dollars in assets under management. So they can buy a board seat, right? They put their own people on the board, although it is the money of the average American that they are using to invest. But they have say on the board. For example, ExxonMobil is told, it's an oil company, and it's told that you should not be drilling anymore. You should, because it's, because of the carbon emissions. So here's an oil company, that's what they're in the business for. But BlackRock has placed its members on the board of Exxon, and so the CEO has to bring down oil production, which hurts Exxon, share price. But of course, their ESG rating is high. Now, if you look at the Silicon Valley Bank, which went down a couple of days ago, they had fantastic ESG rating. In fact, one of the things under the ESG social justice is also, getting more women into the workforce and all of that. And I think 3 or 4 days before the bank went down, the women bankers posted apparently something on LinkedIn, showing how, the women bankers are really doing well at Silicon Valley Bank, and more power to women bankers and things like that, glorifying feminism and this and that, all the woke ideas on social justice. So of course they had a great ESG rating, and then lo and behold, a lot of people, stand to lose a lot of money. So again, where is fiduciary responsibility and what should be done about it versus ESG? Now, in America, what's also happening is as people are waking up to this, there are many that are saying the global forces behind ESG, which is the World Economic Forum in Davos, and these theories, as we show in the book, Snakes in the Ganga, emanating out of Harvard, they are imposing these ideas on corporations, on through the UN onto countries. So countries have a social, a social credit rating. For example, again, to Rajiv Ji's point, a Yale professor recently said about Japan's aging population that maybe the old people should just commit suicide to lessen the burden on the economy of the youngsters, right? In a culture that reveres its, elderly. In Canada, they have expanded their assisted suicide program to people with severe mental illness because the Canadian government thinks that assisted suicide is better than a severe illness, right? These are deep ethical issues. And yet these countries will have higher ESG ratings than India, where we try to keep our elderly with us and revere them and do namaskaram and things like that. So again, goes to show whose idea of social justice or human rights we're talking about. Now, the World Economic Forum also wants, when they have this whole program, to encourage venture capital. See, public companies, you can sort of control with ESG, and there's a stock price, and there's rating, so it's all public. But how do you control venture capitalists, small companies that venture capitalists invest in? So they've come up with a system to do that, to impose these ideas on venture capitalists, and then they want to go into angel investing as well. And one of the things that they casually say is that if venture capitalists should invest in certain companies, especially overseas, they have to get reports from Amnesty International, in NGOs like Amnesty International. Amnesty International has gotten into trouble with the law in India. So if you're a small company wanting venture capital funding, they'll ask you for an Amnesty International report, of the city or the surrounding area or whatever, and that might be negative in terms of human rights. And so this company will not get funding. Tomorrow, if you're a small business and you say, I'm not into venture capital and I'm not going to work for a big company, I'm just going to do my own thing. Say you're making some vases and you're just selling it. The logistics company will refuse to, ship your goods because you're not ESG compliant. Your insurer will refuse to insure you because you're not ESG compliant. So this has deep effects, and like Rajiv Ji said, even I probably won't live long enough to see the full effects of all of this, but it's going to affect all of you. Now, in the US, what they're doing is they're coming up with something called a parallel patriotic economy, because they have realized that this monster is so large and so all-pervasive. It's in the government, it's in corporates, it's in schools. They don't know what to do with it. All the institutions have been captured by the woke. So the only way they think that they can get out, at least in the next decade or so, is to have a parallel economy. So there is a whole platform that's being built for this patriotic economy, where there's none of this ESG crap. So there will be service providers, bankers, lawyers, doctors, all these professionals and small businesses and people who want to take part in this parallel economy. So these are ideas that America is floating. And very soon we have to also think of ideas like this till we defeat this big ESG monster, because as I said, it's everywhere. Now, when you go into a corporation, you are going to have diversity training. Yeah, the HR is going to enforce diversity training on you. Now, in the Snakes in the Ganga book, we talk about how race has become caste in India. So all the race-based training for diversity that they do in America is going to be caste-based training over here. So you'll have race sensitivity training in the West, and you'll have caste sensitivity training over here. Now, what does that mean? So essentially, it's a sort of a three-step process. The first step is to make, so you go into this training, they're going to paint paint a picture which says that all problems of society is because of Hinduism and caste. They give you many examples, give you statistics, all of that. And then you say that, well, maybe true, but I have nothing to do with it. I haven't done anything wrong, and I'm not a casteist, and I hold no bias. In fact, I don't even care what my caste is. You can go on with that. But then the idea is, in the first step, to make you understand your privilege, even if you, as an individual, did not commit any crime. Yeah, because you were born in a certain family, and that makes you culpable. The very fact that you're born to a family which they consider as upper caste or privileged, even though you could have come from very humble beginnings or poor families and things like that, doesn't matter. It is what the woke considers privileged. And if they say you are privileged, you better accept it. Then at the end of it, you say, okay, maybe I do come from a privileged background because I have connections. Caste is sort of a capital that I sort of carry with me, even though I come from a poor background, whatever. You accept that. Then the tamasha begins, where they say, now I'm the DEI guy and I give you the solution. And then you start this process of, it's like the Chinese, Mao's psychological breaking down, right? That's what they do. They psychologically will break you down to accepting that, and you have to accept all kinds of things that you've never did. That you're a casteist, you come from families of oppression, and we've done it historically, we've done it for generations, and therefore you have guilt and shame. And then the next step would be atonement. So Mao did this in his prison, to many people, and this will happen in corporate houses. And so the next piece is the atonement piece, where you will have to say, you can't just virtue signal and say, yeah, sure, I agree, and I'm with you, buddy, good, yeah, let's get out of here. That's not going to happen. What it means to atone is to be an active participant. You can't be passively saying, yeah, good, I'm with you, in spirit, yeah, I agree with you. That doesn't cut it. They want your active participation. And what does active participation mean? It means you have to become an activist. You have to go out there and, we were in the Hyderabad Central University today, with protesters and all that. So you have to actually go and protest. You have to become an ally where you fight these causes. You use your so-called privilege to break down society, which is considered, built on privilege. So this is what they mean by active participation, being an ally. So these sort of words, right? You have to understand what it means. So being an ally is not, okay, I'm an ally, I'm a friend. It's not like that. Being an ally means active participation. So whenever you see all these words in the lexicon of the left, you have to ask yourself, what is the definition? What is diversity? So diversity means bringing in certain people at the expense of others. Equity means not everybody is equal. You push down some people and you bring up some people. So you make it unequal so that outcome is equal, right? And inclusion is essentially excluding certain populations, marginalized or, these synthetic identities, right, that they come up with to bring, to include others. So they all have opposite meanings and totally different meanings. It sounds very good on the surface. Like, who is not for environmental sustainability? Who is not for it? So everything has to be, you have to question everything, get clear definitions. What does it mean? What does it entail? What does it to, you know, what does it mean to be an ally? What does it mean, you know, so you and you should refuse participation in such brainwashing in a business house. And I would also say that since you all are young, you should take risks and even quit jobs to make a statement if you're forced to do that. Because what is a life is not worth living if you haven't lived it with conviction and courage. Right? And you can do it when you're young. And so question everything and don't succumb to peer pressure and these Western ideas and Western standards of diversity, equity, inclusion. The last thing I want to tell you is even these organizations like United Nations, UNESCO have all been bought out. The WHO is bought out by the Gates Foundation and the Chinese. In fact, last week, they had 193 countries sign a pandemic treaty. We didn't vote for it. So your healthcare professional, whatever he might say you have a family doctor, you love going to Ayurveda, and they say that these are sort of the prescriptions I'll give you for a certain, this is the diagnosis and this is how I want to treat you. That's not going to work because India signed a treaty with the WHO, to say that, you know, they will decide. The next pandemic is, I don't know if it's being planned or is coming. And they will decide when to lock down, whom to lock down, how long to lock down, what you should wear. Now you know that masks are not, you know, they don't really work. But of course, you're forced to wear masks. So these are all ways to, these are practice sessions, if you will, to control people. And this is the beginning of the social credit system. You have to look at it from a meta level, bigger level. And this whole idea of central bank digital currency is another thing. It's great. You can avoid black money, all of that. It has its plus side. But on the downside, think about it. Say you don't obey. Say you're under lockdown and you say, you know what, I'm tired of being in the house. I just need to go for a walk. And somebody catches you. Your digital currency is now a coupon. Because if you disobey, I can just, it's not money anymore. It's a coupon. It's like a welfare check, right? You go and so people can turn it off, like tap, you know, you can turn it off and on. So the central bank digital currency is great. But if your social credit, you know, score is low, they can just turn it off and leave you high and dry with no access to your own hard-earned money. So this is where this whole thing is going. Your money is a coupon that can be turned off if you do not behave and if you're not obedient. This is the world that you guys are going to be living in. And good luck to you.